I'm Jamie.
And I'm Beth. Welcome to Thief Steals the Podcast.
Where I steal the podcast.
And I steal it back.
Okie dokie. Today we are talking about the Give Me a K street job. Beth, what did you think?
Well, first of all, Jamie, cheerleaders, I was actually right on the fucking money with dead my on. Prediction. Yep. And that doesn't happen very often.
The so only thing
I'm going to take a second to appreciate this feeling.
The only thing I will say is you did miss the complete, like,
oh, yeah,
legislative...
Yeah.
Sort of element of it. Mm. But to be fair, I don't think, like, we can really blame you for that. Like, I think when you think cheerleaders, you don't also think Congress.
Yeah, no. Typically, I keep those things separate in my mind. But, yeah, so I was very excited that I was correct about cheerleaders. Mm. This episode was really interesting for me. I think that as an episode of television, personally, like... It was kind of mid. Like, yep. It was fine. I didn't feel like I was like, oh my God, I love this episode. I want to rewatch it. Like, blah, blah, blah. But I was also like, it was like relatively enjoyable as a piece of media.
Yeah.
But I do think it did something really, really interesting mm-hmm. in the way that it portrayed politics and the intricacies in that. Mm-hmm. Like, I actually really enjoyed the political aspect of the episode.
I think when you're looking at it from that sort of way, I think the most interesting thing is Sophie's plotline, this thing.
Yeah.
And the way that it was like, she literally just wanted to like get this one thing, but to get this one thing, she had to get another thing. And the way it's all like chain reactions of like, I'll do this favor for you, but you do this favor for me.
Yeah.
But like, and all of the way that she had to like, just keep on going further and further and further and further back mm-hmm. and how it all becomes so much like, it's all a big compromise, but people have to be really, truly desperate to compromise. Like, it's not just like a, oh, I like, you know, I want to do you a favor, so you'll do me a favor. It's not like a one-to-one sort of thing.
No, it's like thousands of competing interests. And like, the thing is, one of the things that I really appreciated that they did was they set up this guy to look like kind of a prick. Right. Yeah. And like, he was just desperate to retain power. And then Sophie comes in and he's like, no, I'm trying to get these damn subsidies for my farmers, you know, and like, I'm desperate to like support these constituents. And then
so that I can get reelected. But to do that, I need to be able to actually go back to my constituents and do what I told them what I was going to do.
And like, he's like, yes, he is driven to be reelected, but a primary reason that he's driven to that is because he wants to feed back to the community.
Yeah.
So then she's like, oh, okay, he's not who we thought. So then she goes to the other person and then you find out that actually that's to do with ethanol and that's like, you know, unclean energy. And so like, it just, it's so interesting because I think what often happens in media and in like stories, right, just generally across the board, obviously you have like your protagonists and you have your antagonists. And I think that they're usually very clearly defined. And that's when you have like moral gray characters, it can be like a really fun break because you're like, oh, you know, they don't have any clear moral drive. So it makes them stand out. Mm. And I think that in politics, you have that too, because so much of particularly like we get exported a lot of American politics, we see it fucking everywhere. And so one of the things that is really noticeably different about like American campaigns compared to Australian ones is that they have campaigns. Like we have campaigns, but not like Americans do. And so what is interesting to me is that like it becomes so much a narrative. It becomes the story. You're selling the story of this politician. You're not selling what they want to do. Like, and so, or if you are selling that, you're selling it under the guise of, you know, whatever their messaging is. And so it's really, really interesting the way that these real people, these politicians become characters in a narrative rather than workers in a workplace performing a job role.
Yeah.
And I think that this particular episode just highlights it so, so well because all of these characters, like even the asshole who, like LaGrange, right?
Yeah.
Who's like, his whole thing is he's talking about like, oh, it's government overreach and like, but he has a line where he says, like, if we start letting big government into our high schools. And I was like, if they're public high schools, they're literally government. What is your argument here? Right. But it's like fear mongering.
Yeah.
And he's clearly pandering to the political right. Mm-hmm. You know, that's his kind of his drive. And they make a point in the episode that he doesn't want young voters coming in because he knows that his fundamental values do not align with the younger voters. Yes, right. And so that's a threat
to him.
The older,
more conservative sort
viewpoint.
Of viewpoint.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not like, you know, it's they also do this thing with him where they're not like, oh, well, he's just a completely irredeemable dickhead.
Yes, this is what my point is going to be. Because, yes, do I agree with his political views? Absolutely not. But the integrity that he has in refusing to take a bribe, in refusing to, you know, stoop, I suppose, and he knows his limits. He's not looking for more power. Like, I actually really respected a lot of the things about his the way that he had integrity in his work and the way that he held himself as a person. Do I agree with his political alignments? No. But do I have respect for the way he held himself in his job role? Yes. And I thought that that was really, really, really interesting, particularly for Leverage, who, as like a media narrative, so commonly has these like stereotype caricature villains.
Yeah.
It was so fascinating to see this whole like B-plot cast of like really complicated characters who are all fundamentally like driven by their own like wants and desires, but all of their wants and desires like are simultaneously morally good and morally corrupt, and they all cross over each other. And I was like, this is actually potentially the most realistic like exploration of what it actually is to be in political fields that I have ever seen. Because it really showed that, yes, there are villains in politics. I'm not trying to say that there aren't.
But and I think like, that's the vast really clearly majority exemplified by the fact that Nate literally had one where he could walk in and go, I just want to buy your vote, essentially. And he was like, yeah, sure, fucking go for it.
Absolutely. Like, it's so interesting because I think that, you know, there are people who get into politics for, you know, despicable reasons. But I think, I would like to think anyway, the vast majority of people who go into politics because they want to make changes.
Yeah.
And they like, and no one goes in going, I want to make bad changes. Like everyone goes in believing in their cause. And it,
even the politician that Hardison has assigned, they're like, well, she'll vote for it if she knows that it's girls' lives at stake.
Yeah.
But they didn't account for the fact that cheerleading has such a reputation of being like just an excuse for essentially young girls to like wear cheerleading uniforms to school.
Yeah, it's that it's like social narrative.
That social around narrative around it of like, I'm not going to take funding from actual women's sports, quote unquote, as if cheerleaders aren't athletes.
Yeah, but also it's really interesting because she then makes the point of like, okay, so you've got this concern. It's a valid concern, right? She never says it's not valid.
No.
But she says, she makes the point, she's like, I'm not taking funds from other areas of education, from women's sports generally, from the arts, from, because she has a point. You cannot just give money to these areas because you have to take that money from somewhere else. And then Hardison has this point where he's like, okay, well, here's this money that's been allocated to the Pentagon. They actively do not want it. And then she's like, but we can't just take it because that money has to be there. Like the way that the system is structured requires it to be accessible by the Pentagon, even if they say we don't want it. And it's so fascinating. Like there's this really funny thing that happens like annually in our local area. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but it is the sudden appearance of roadworks. And it literally happens every single fucking year without fail and around this, about the same times. And you can say like, okay, it's like weather-based, because sure.
But I think it is partially weather-based. I think it's also partially when they do their funding, they decide which roadworks need to be completed. They open up for the bidding process. Once they've chosen a concrete to complete them, they always start around the same time because it's just after.
It's actually not even that. Yeah. Like, it is partially, but a big component of it is that each district is allocated a certain amount of funding, right? And if you do not use up all your funding, it comes back as, well, you clearly didn't need that much funding. So next annual year, we won't give you as much. So it is a push to use all the funding so that you can then say, well, look, we used all of our funding. Clearly, we cannot have less than this. If anything, you should give us more.
Mm.
And so it is this hilarious, like, it's not funny.
No.
But like the concept of it is just so ridiculous that it becomes like you have to laugh or you just cry.
It's because it's almost like they've procrastinated doing the shit that needs to be done all year. And they're like, oh fuck, our funding's about to expire.
Yeah.
So we need to do it now.
Quick, let's do all these community projects now.
Yeah.
Prove that we needed the funding. Mm-hmm. But then the problem is they can't have done that the whole year through, because if they legitimately put money into the things that required money in the community for the entire 12-month period, they would run out of money by the 6-month mark. Mm. So like they're frugal and scrupulous the whole fucking year. And then they get to like, you know, October and they go, shit, we've got all this money. We have to use it. Mm. And so like it's this silly, silly, silly cycle. And it's so interesting. I think politics at a, like a base level, like a community, immediate community level, all the way up to federal to international, honestly, like the way that money is allocated and the way that some of the like laws and regulations are so, so, so outdated. Like Hardison looking at laws about haberdashery, you know, and
that's the key thing. So both the Australian and the American legal system
based in British
is based in the British. And the way that it works is essentially you can't ever remove a law. Like, if something gets passed into law, it is law. Mm. The only way you can get rid of a law is writing a different law that then, like, negates the original law, if that makes sense. So if you have something that's, like, you know, not actively doing harm, why you're not going to waste time
removing
the law by writing a new law to try and remove this law if it's not actively doing harm. So as a result, you have all of these laws that just
kind of exist for no reason.
That are no longer really accurate because no one goes through the law and says, okay, well, it's been 20 years since we've done this last. The world has changed. We need to go through and make sure the law reflects the modern world. All we keep on doing is just writing
new laws.
And so you just sort of slowly, like, pile them on top of each other.
Mm.
And then if you do have a law that is actively causing harm, normally you can, like, very specifically repeal that law through a different piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't, like, unless you actually repeal it through legislation, they're just there and they just build up on top of each other. And, like, the amount of laws that go through, but then because they're, you know, they're written, you could interpret them
many different ways.
Two or three or four ways. And so they get interpreted this one way, which is not the way that was intended. So then they write a new law to try and band-aid fix the fact that that law did not work as intended.
Yeah, yeah. It's literally the way that, and, you know, there's a lot of jokes in, like, the queer community, especially. It's like, oh, a lot of wars say, like, no man nor woman. It's like, okay, cool. So non-binary people can commit as many crimes as they want.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like these, like, loopholes. Or I remember there being one particular instance that I saw where I think it was, I can't remember which country it was now, but basically it was a lesbian couple, one of the partners in which was transgender. And it was like, okay, well, if you will not, like, legally recognize my gender identity, then you must recognize my marriage because if you will not respect that I identify as female, then therefore I am still male and you have to respect our marriage as legal because it is a man and a woman being married, not two women.
Yeah.
And so it's like this funny little thing where it's like, yeah, you can, because it is so specific, like there are ways you can bend it and get around it in some regards. But like one of the notes that I took in this episode was that I think it was actually doing something really clever in the way that they were presenting the way governments run and why it can be so hard to take things through the proper channels to make change, which, like, just exemplifies leverage as a show. Like, I think that they had this episode in season 5 is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I think the only other place they could have put it where it would have been as interesting or impactful is actually season 1. Like, because I think that this episode is either setting up the show or closing out the show. Yeah. And I think putting it anywhere in the middle seasons, like, just wouldn't have had the same resonance, I don't think. And then, yeah, Hardison's point about the Pentagon not actually wanting the money is such a good example. And then going through and finding all these outdated laws. Like, honestly, it's ridiculous to me that there isn't some kind of clause that's like each, like, law must be, reviewed and renewed after a certain amount of time. Like, you know, if you have to, like, retake your driver's test after, like, you know. I feel like after a certain point, like, we should have to review things. Like, it should be compulsory. If someone is studying law or politics, you know, just generally, and has, like, more information to add on this that maybe we just don't know about because neither of us did that, let us know. Like,
and also the American legal system works slightly different to Australian as well. Like,
oh, I have a note on that, actually.
We both copied the British.
In different ways. Mm-hmm. I have a point about this. And actually, I have a red flag.
Ooh.
In our baby girl Parker.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to try and take a guess what I think it is?
I don't want to take a guess, but I will say, though, calling her a baby girl Parker isn't really accurate because she does say this episode she was never really a teenage girl. And this episode is Parker non-binary rights. So.
Oh, fun. Fun, fun. I feel like that is a really cool way to take that. I more interpret it as, like, I was never really what you would consider a normal teenage girl, but I absolutely love the interpretation. So,
for me, there's two ways you can interpret it. One, she didn't really have a childhood. She was forced to grow up too fast. She was never really a teenager. She
took it as childhood trauma.
Childhood trauma adjacent, going basically from child to adult without really that formative teenage years that most people get.
There was no real intermission
period. Or two, if you're going to be, like, purposefully a little, because I think that's how it was originally intended, or the better interpretation, non-binary Parker being like, well, the girl thing is what's wrong with that sentence.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's really fun. No, the red flag that I spotted was her at the very end of the episode saying, I don't vote. And now here's the thing. We don't get a choice here. It is legally compulsory. You can throw your vote. You can rock up at the booth and just put in a blank ballot or like whatever. But honestly, you're already there. You may as fucking well. I swear to God, we did not fight for the right for women to vote in this country and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to vote in this country, for people to show up at the voting booth and not actually fucking vote. I will die on that hill. So
what I will say though is I think one of the reasons Parker's like, I don't vote is because like, she doesn't have an alias that she could vote under.
Okay.
Like.
Okay.
Because that's committing election fraud. Like, I don't think she's held what under her, enough. Like,
legal name?
I don't think she has any of her ID under her legal name. If that makes sense. Like, because you got to prove who you are.
I mean, not.
Like,
I mean, don't... I guess it depends on how the polling system, but we don't really. We just show up and we give them our name and they just tick you off.
Yeah. They right. ask you, have you voted in this election before?
Yeah, and you say no. And why every would year, I vote twice?
And then every year, like, I like the way they say it, I'm like, I voted in an election before. No, like, not this not one. Not this but one. Like...
yeah. No. So for anyone who's unfamiliar with Australian politics, which honestly, I wouldn't be shocked. Anyone who doesn't live in Australia, because I get the vibe that we hear a lot more about, like, American politics here than America would hear about our politics. And primarily a lot of our listeners are American or actually European. So, you know, hello. But... I think what is really interesting and different about, like, voting here is that not only is it compulsory, like, after you turn 18, you must vote.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, like, you know,
you get fined.
And also, like, you know, it takes, what, 10 minutes max? Like,
depending on where you go.
Yeah, but, like, I mean, you can do postal voting. Like, it's very flexible. But the other thing is that we vote differently. Mm-hmm. So we have preferential voting, which is, I think, personally, a superior system to single ballot voting.
Superior system.
Because it basically means, like, you hear a lot, and specifically, you know, we hear a lot because we get a lot of American politics sort of pushed over, but that, you know, don't waste your vote. So basically, like, you know, you wouldn't vote for, say, a Greens candidate, essentially, because the Greens are never going to get in because the Democrats will win out over the Greens. Like, it's a bigger party, right? Yeah. So you vote for one of the two major parties, either Democrats or Republican, because if you vote for anyone else, you're basically wasting your vote. We don't have that here.
No.
Because you can vote for basically all of the parties, or, like, up to six, I think it is, and... you just put them in order of preference. So if I can put the Greens as my top voting preference, I can put them as my number one, and then I can put however many of the other more minor parties between them and who I would normally vote for. I know that none of those minor parties are going to get the top election result, but I also want it to go through all the other ones first. Like, I want them to have on record that I would prefer all of these other ones first.
So basically, you look at the ballot and you go, which ones do I want to vote for? And you just vote for them in your order of preference.
Yeah. Anyway.
But you can't really waste your vote in Australia, which is really
good. Unless you just don't vote. Like, unless you rock up and you just put a blank ballot in, or you draw, like, a silly picture on it or whatever.
You
like,
put in a donkey vote.
That's just silly, in my personal opinion. Anyway. We've spent 20 minutes talking about this.
About politics.
Oh, I do have a couple of other quick notes that I want to make before we move entirely off of it.
Yeah.
Number one, government's just a system, and if it's a system, we can hack it. I actually really enjoy that quote. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I like sort of the take on it. I think it's really fun comparatively to, like, can't hack a hick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that is, it's really fun. Like, an individual person you can't hack, but a system of people you can. Like, I think that is really fascinating. And also, it's a bill to keep high school girls out of wheelchairs. Who on earth is going to vote against it? Immediately followed by
all of them wanting to vote against it.
Yeah. And also... the fucking way that LaGrange was using the strong, independent woman argument against women's safety drove me insane. I was like, God, they were so accurately depicting conservative politics right now. It hurts. Like,
it's like, but they don't want big government in their, you know, things. It's like, yeah, but if you look at the statistics, statistically, they need better safety measures. And while it's not classified as a sport, they're not going to get them.
The irony of this, like, older white,
but he was a quarterback, so he knows a thing about cheerleaders.
Standing there and being like, these women don't want an old man telling them what to do. And I'm like, you're right. So why are you talking? why don't we ask them? Why are you making this decision? You're right. They don't want you making this decision. So why are you making it?
I will say, though, I'm really glad that in the cheerleader episode, they had the villain be a woman.
Yeah, I did think that was interesting, actually.
Because we get so few female villains in Leverage. I do love that she is the epitome of gatekeep gaslight girl boss. Like, she's out here girl bossing her way to the top. Like, she's just really, she's fucking killing it. And, like, is she a horrible human being? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, like, you gotta admire her drive.
Also, I find it really interesting because she was talking to Nate towards the end of the episode and she's saying, like, I found a niche and I exploited it. And she was saying, like, you know, cheerleaders, everyone always underestimates them. Like, I never did. And I was like, okay, like, you have a good point. You may not have underestimated them, but you've certainly undervalued them, which honestly is almost the same thing. Like, you did not underestimate their...
But you exploited them.
Yeah. You did not underestimate their potential, but then you extraordinarily undervalued them.
Yeah.
So, like, that's like discovering a gold mine and being like, I'm not going to underestimate this, and then selling your gold for pennies. Like, what do you mean? Like, I was like, I understand, like, the point that they're making here, but I was like, I feel like it's kind of like that whole thing of, like, corporations where they're like, you know, we value our employees, like, they're what drive the company, and then they pay them shit, and they give them horrible working conditions, and they make it just, like,
and then they act surprised when all of their employees quit.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, or when they want to unionize.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, duh. Like, you can't on one hand be like, oh, like, this amazing thing, and then be like, but we're gonna treat it like shit.
Yeah.
Like, that just does not compute. I do have a question for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
I am not sure if this is just something that I was missing.
Yeah.
Like, I am actually pretty sure it must be something I'm missing because I don't understand how it really works. So when they are trying to pressure her into buying the company out quicker, right? And so they're trying to pressure her into pulling money from something that'll get her in trouble, which I totally understand. Mm-hmm. The way that she's doing it, because she's the CEO, is that right? Of Cheer.
Yeah.
Or like Pep Sport or whatever. Pep. Yeah.
Pep Athletics.
Okay, so she is the CEO of Pep Athletics, and Pep Athletics is the umbrella company for like 20 other companies. Is that right? Okay. So she is trying to independently, like herself, buy Pep to privatize the whole thing. Is that correct?
So she's trying to basically get Pep to buy itself out.
Okay. Because this is where you lose me. Because I was like, how is she pulling money out of the subordinate companies to purchase the umbrella? Like, how is
she? So I'm going to guess it was a publicly traded company.
Uh-huh.
And so she's basically they're buying out the shareholders. So they're basically buying their shares from the shareholders so that the company does not have any shareholders anymore. They are a private company owned outright.
I guess it just doesn't, it confuses me that the money, it's just buying itself. Like, you already have the money, so are you just giving yourself
it's basically giving the shareholders the money so they no longer have any control over the company. It's buying their shares off of them.
Yeah, I guess, but then don't they all have to agree to that?
Yeah, but the way, like, shares are traded, it's not too hard to buy them off.
I don't know. It just seemed very confusing to me.
To be fair, I understand. The whole idea is that this company is meant to be confusing as shit.
Okay.
They literally say the structure looks like a fucking, like the mob. Like,
because
that's why they bring them down to the RICO case, because they're like, the company structure is so convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so basically, my guess is that she probably owns some shares as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal is to basically buy out everyone else's share, so she becomes the sole shareholder. So the company owns like 90% of itself, and then she owns the other 10%, which means that she would have full control over the company.
Okay, because the way that I think where I'm getting confused is, in my mind, it would be the sole, like, she would own it in its entirety. And I was kind of like, that doesn't make any sense because she can't use the company's money to buy something for her.
No,
do you know what can't. I mean? But I was like, she would have to find her funds from somewhere, that she can't use the company's funds to buy it for herself.
If she can basically get it so that she is the only person in charge as the CEO.
Yeah.
AKA get rid of the board of directors and the shareholders.
So she's not actually buying more of it herself. She's just buying it back to this company.
She's getting rid of the others.
Okay. Which gives her more, I was confused.
Which gives her more control over the company.
Mm-hmm.
Because then she doesn't have shareholders that she has to answer to.
Yes. Okay. No, I got it. I got it. Mm-hmm. I was just confused because I was like, but that's not her money. She can't use the company's money to buy the company for her. That's not her money. Mm-hmm. That's like, you know, Kmart's money or whatever. You can't just... Okay, cool. Cool. I also love Hardison fact-checking them against the old laws. It's literally so fucking funny.
And I love the fact that what he does with it is he blocks a whole bunch of, like, things because it's technically illegal. And then... the one thing that is actually fully, like, illegal enough to get them fully investigated mm-hmm. is the one thing that he doesn't block. And they just assume because there were no, like, red flags blinking at them that it's, like, it's fine. It's like, that money's fine. You know what I mean? Like,
fucking iconic. I also love the quote, "You're swimming in my pool now, Guppy." Something about that, loved it. Mm-hmm. Really loved it. Oh, I do have a couple of notes that I just want to, it's something that I talk about a lot, so I just want to chuck it out here. But 3 times this episode, it was so annoying, it drove me crazy. Parker, yet again, obviously speaking to them all on FaceTime, very loudly, in a crowded area, amongst a bunch of people. And then later on in the episode, Nate is walking down the fucking hallway of the government building, fully yelling. And then a couple scenes later, Sophie doing the same fucking thing, walking down a staircase, I think, also yelling. I'm like, kids, can we not?
I will just say, the Nate and Sophie ones, yes. Parker, I don't think it's that weird to be on FaceTime in a public space. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she's clearly on a call to someone, and I don't think she says anything, like, it's not like talking crime in the street level. You know what I mean?
She's
like,
talking about pushing Hardison off buildings.
Yeah.
Which I did love Elliot's response of being like, I thought it was funny, Parker.
Which, you know, so valid of him. It was very funny. It's not their fault that Hardison thinks that a 20-foot drop is a lot.
Mm. Also, I love his cardigan in that scene, like the very opening sort of one where they're chilling and talking about the case initially. Like, love it. It's giving, like, Taylor Swift Evermore folklore era cardigan, and
Let's face it, Hardison would be a Swiftie.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. In my opinion, that's canon.
Yeah.
Also, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of... this episode is talking about, like, what it takes to hook different marks, you know? Yeah. And Nate and Elliot actually have a discussion at the very end.
Which I do think need to talk about.
We need to discuss. Mm-hmm. But on that, what do you think our hooks would be?
Ooh.
Because it made me think, I was like, damn, what would be the thing?
You know what? I think I'm like, I would be almost comically easy to hook in. Like, promise to meet my friend and I'll do anything, even start a Supernatural podcast with you.
I love every time you bring up the story of, like, us starting the podcast, it makes it sound like I fucking bribed you. It makes it sounds like I was like, here, Jamie. Which is absolutely not what happened, but, oh, it's such a funny way to think about it. Because I was thinking about, I was like, okay, if Nate was casing me as a mark, what would be the thing that would get me? Because I don't really care about money or, like, you know, I don't know. Like, and I hate the idea of being in a position of power. I think that would be the worst. But, like, genuinely, I was trying to think about it, and I was like, I think it would literally just be, like, I would be that stereotypical, like, if you threatened me, I wouldn't care, but if you threatened my friends, my family, and my dog, like, I'm like John Wick. If you took my dog, I'd end you. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, I think that would be mine. I think it would just be, like, if someone wanted to extort me, no one listens to this podcast is going to try and extort me, but...
You don't know. Our target demographic might have shifted a bit while we were on strike.
But, like, you know, that would be the way to do it, I think. That would be my hook, would be friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say the decoding really just popped out there for, you for a second. But no, I don't even know. Like, obviously I like stuff, but, like, I'm not one for, like, I'm not...
Yours would be, like... gift vouchers to JB Hi-Fi's, you can get 1,000 new records.
But, like, no, like, I just, yeah, I don't know, like, I don't think I really have.
Oh, everyone's got one.
Like, they do also say that you can't con an honest man, though.
Are you saying I'm not an honest person?
Yes.
That's rude.
Here's the thing, I feel like there's a difference between, like, manipulating someone and conning someone, if that makes sense. Like,
oh, okay, that's
you know fair. What I mean, like.
But that's the thing, because I'm also very gullible.
Yeah.
I feel like I could be easily conned.
That's what I mean. Like, I would be so easily conned. Okay. I just don't think I have, like, a specific hook. You know what I mean? Like.
Yeah. Actually, the problem is that we have too many.
Yeah. Like, you know, just got to manipulate a couple of them and you're fine. Like.
Oh, dear. We're like puppets on strings.
But no. So, yes, we do actually need to talk about the conversation between Nate and Elliot at the end of the episode. How are you feeling about it? Do you have any thoughts on it? Any predictions based on it?
Actually, yeah. So
okay.
I think this is his This has cemented for me something that I've been talking about this whole season. Yeah. And I actually can't remember if we started talking about it in, like, the season 4 wrap-up or not. But for me, it's been, like, very prominent so far in these first 5 episodes, which is this idea that I think that Nate is setting them up so that he can retire.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely, the more that I watch, the more I'm like, I absolutely am convinced this is where they're going with this. Because it feels like he is checking that all of them are going to be good. Yeah. So that he can retire, and he can retire in the knowledge that, you know, the baby birds have flown the nest and they're not going to crash and burn. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that he is setting them up with the cushion of a safety net so that they are not so dependent on him, and specifically Sophie as well. Like, because there's been a big focus on pushing them out of their boundaries and making sure that they can do things like grift and do things like analyze the situation from a broader perspective, which are specifically his and Sophie's roles. Like, I think that honestly, if this season doesn't end with Nate and Sophie just kind of like retiring from the con sort of life so that she can run her theater and Nate can, like, I don't know, run some kind of, like, you know, bar or financial, like, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think they're going to fully retire, but I think they might retire into what we would call quote unquote normal jobs.
Retire from crime.
Yeah. And so I think that that is maybe, like, for example, like, maybe Sophie runs the actual theater and Nate runs the, like, ticket sales, marketing, like, opening night bar kind of thing. Yeah. Like, and then that leaves Parker, Hardison, and Elliot to kind of go forth as the progeny, you know, the prodigies of crime, as it were.
Yeah.
And, like, they still, like, they're, like, a good, you know, decade or so younger than Nate and Sophie. Like, they are not going to be wanting to get out of this field. Like, they're essentially, like, in their peak, right? And so I think that Nate and Sophie have reached a point where they're like, you know what, like, we have other passions that we want to follow. We are set for life. We don't need more money. And we've fulfilled our passions in this area. So we're ready to move into something else. But they don't want to move into something else without setting up a strong foundation for their kids. And, like, that for me is, like, what I'm getting. But the conversation with Elliot in this episode was also a little bit sus to me. Purely in the sense that I think Elliot feels suspicious.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and he says to Nate, you know, like, I trust that you'll tell me very soon what this is all about.
Yeah.
And the way that the camera, like, lingered on Elliot after Nate, like, walked away from that gave me the feeling that, like, whatever is going on, like, Elliot is not super comfy with it. And it was kind of, like, reminiscent of season 3 for me.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting because, like, if my theory is true, then Elliot doesn't really have anything to worry about.
Yeah.
But, like, obviously other than, like, just the change generally in the crew and, like, the stability of that, I suppose. But, like, ultimately, like, it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
It would be a growth opportunity for all of them.
Yeah.
And so I feel
it's
like
the sort of thing where it would be sad for them for Nate and Sophie to retire because they love Nate and Sophie.
Yeah.
But it's also, like, in this version of events, Nate and Sophie aren't dropping off the grid, never to be seen again, like, die in a tragic car accident or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
and so I wonder, because here's the thing. My thought is that in season 3, the way that Elliot was, like, portrayed and stuff was obviously because he was in a position where he was going to betray the team, or rather, like, he was hiding something from them that could be, you know, viewed as a betrayal of their trust, right? And so, like, this also feels like an imminent betrayal. But I think that that depends on your perspective. Because you could look at Nate and Sophie deciding to retire and not be part of the crew anymore as a betrayal. You could look at that as abandonment. You could look at that as rejection, right? But I don't think that that is what Nate would at all be intending, or Sophie for that matter.
Yeah.
I think that it is looking at, like, just a parting of ways, a natural conclusion, a, like, amicable, you know, decision on all parties' counts. And so I think that it's interesting that it feels like it's being framed as this ominous thing. And I'm wondering if it's maybe just to kind of, like, tease the audience. It's like, ooh, you know, like, what sinister, like, thing is brewing? Yeah. And, like, for me, like, I just don't believe it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, like, if something sinister were to happen, I would be surprised.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I'm wondering if, basically what I'm saying is, I'm wondering if they're trying to falsely lure the audience into thinking that some terrible, horrible thing is coming, and then the big reveal is going to be, like, we bought a condo. You know, like, you know, they sit all down and, like, you know, it's like that whole thing where it's like, you know, when someone sits you down and you're really worried, they're going to tell you, like, they're dying or something, and it feels really serious, and they tell you the most ridiculous thing. They're like, okay, like, it's really important. I just need to just sit and be real with me for a minute. Like, don't laugh. Like, don't, like, you know, whatever. And you're like, okay, shit, this is important. And then they go, I think I'm going to adopt a dog. And you're like, okay, that, I thought you had a terminal illness. Yep. The way that you fucking sat me down for this, you know, like.
Like, how is that
so
what you wanted to say to me?
Yeah, that's kind of the energy that I'm getting. Like, maybe that's what they're setting up for. Because, yeah, I just can't see them giving Nate or Sophie or any of them really, like, a tragic end.
Mm-hmm.
And, or, like, and it's the last season. It's not, are they going to set up some huge fucking betrayal? It just doesn't feel right.
They've now been working together for 5 years. Like, yeah. It doesn't really make a lot of narrative sense to now set up a betrayal. You know what I mean?
Like, and, like, the thing is, like, with shows like Supernatural, you can, or, like, Merlin, you know, you can because there's, like, elements involved of magic and stuff. And so people can be manipulated in different ways. Like, possessed.
Yeah.
You know, like, if this was Supernatural, I'd be like, maybe Nate's possessed. But, like, you know, he's not. Because it's leverage. So, yeah, I don't know. That's where I'm sitting.
But that's okay. Look, I obviously cannot say anything. I can certainly see how you've come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see what you think of where they go with it.
I'm interested to see what I think of where they go with it, to be perfectly honest.
But, yeah, I think, yeah, I don't think you're wrong at all when you say, like, they're very clearly setting up something. Mm. Like, clearly this is part of the larger overarching plot of the season, which you must admit there's not a lot of overarching plot of this season. Like,
there's not that much overarching plot of any season, if we're being totally real. Leverage is not an overarching plot type of show.
No.
And, like, that's totally fine. It is what it says on the tin. It doesn't say that it's some big load.
No.
It's a silly, fun show for vibes.
Vibes only in this household.
Mm, yeah.
There is one scene that I really do just want to talk about real quick.
Please.
The scene, I think it's one of the funniest scenes in the whole show, where fucking Nate and Park are interrogating this, like, cheerleader, and they're like, sure, you could pair it up. Like,
oh my
it's
God.
So unnecessary.
Do you know what is so funny? Is I did not like that scene. I felt so uncomfortable for poor Angela. I was like, why are, like, and these two characters are normally the two characters, like, outside of, like, maybe Elliot, who usually relate so well to scared children.
Yeah.
And I was like, why are you freaking her out? Like, calm the fuck down. This is not a criminal investigation. She is a teenager who is trying to cover for her friend who is literally just sitting in a room. Like, that's, she is just sitting in a room. She's not doing some horrible illicit. She's not trying to cover up a crime or a murder. She is sitting in a room having a little bit of crying. Calm the fuck down.
Just because you also most of the time want to be sitting in a room just having a little cry doesn't mean anything bad.
Jamie, you don't call me out like that.
Look, there's just something so ridiculous about it, and I just think it's very fun.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy it immensely. Just because you have no taste doesn't mean anything.
The humor of it is apparent. For me, it was more just, like, kind of confusing. I was just like, okay, like, I see what you're going for. But these two characters particularly, like, if it was Hardison and Sophie,
yeah,
I think it would have made way more sense than it being Nate and Parker. Like, purely from a character perspective.
I just want them to have a fun little silly time sometimes. You know what I mean? Like,
it's only because of the scared kid narrative.
Yeah.
Like, I think that Sophie and Hardison having the same scene would have been a really different energy to Parker and Nate. But I think Parker and Nate are so intense.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it did though give me that we get this scene of Cass, I want to say in like season 7-8, like it's in like that kind of area. And he really, really specifically is convinced that this cat is suspicious. And he's like, I'll go interrogate the cat. And like, you know, we get some really intense interrogation scenes with Cass where he's trying real hard. You know, he's got the spirit, but he's a bit confused. You know, he, like, fully accuses some woman of killing her husband on, like, zero fucking, no warm-up.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gave me that energy, which I did enjoy. One genuine question I do have, actually. Okay.
Yep.
Is that I'm wondering how, because, like, obviously the plot of this episode is that the mats and safety equipment are not up to scratch. Like, they're not meeting any kind of.
They're designed to be cheap, not to be safe.
Yeah, exactly, which, like, defeats the fucking purpose. What is interesting to me is, like, obviously, like, throughout the episode, we get a lot of stunts. Like, they're actually showing, like, the cheerleaders doing their routines and stuff, which, first of all, freaking impressive.
Yeah.
And second of all, I'm interested to know how they ensured the safety of the actual performers whilst also making it look like they weren't upholding any safety standards. Do you know what I mean? Because they were talking about, like, we need these mats and things. It's like, but clearly you don't. And that's the whole point. So you can't actually have them. And so I was like, is it like spring?
I think it might just be clever set design.
Mm.
Like, I think that genuinely might be it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a show where they're very specifically making a point of, like, this is not safe, they've probably just disguised, like, some of their mats as the actual floor. So the mats look thinner than they actually are. You know what I mean? Like,
because I was like, really trying to look.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that's a really interesting, like, conundrum, I guess, from, like, a set perspective. It's like, how do we make it look specifically unsafe? And it's also, like, not like it's the kind of stunt where it's, like, CGI. Like, it's not like they're jumping off a building and it's like, okay, well, that's not a safe thing to do. But, like,
that's green screen. We can see that.
Yeah. You know, this is like, okay, this is a practical stunt. The whole point of it is that it needs to be not safe, but it also actually needs to be safe for the performers.
Yeah.
And I was like looking and I was like, it's whatever they've done has worked very impressively because you cannot tell.
Yeah.
The only thing that I could think that maybe they've done is like, you know, in like the Olympic floor routines for like gymnastics and stuff, and they basically have that big flat expanse, but it's like springy like a trampoline. Yeah. I was like, maybe they've used like a similar... Mm-hmm. kind of mat.
Yeah. I'd say it's just a clever trick with perspectives and set design. Like, they've just very specifically filmed it so that they might have even had extra mats on hand so that if they're filming the scenes where they need the extra mats, because only some stunts would require it. Some stunts would be fine to
like
do.
Like the big tosses and stuff.
But the big tosses and that. And then they've specifically filmed it from such an angle that you can't see, like,
the
edge of the, you know, because, like, that's the other thing. Like, if you're just looking, like, top down, you can't see the edge and you can't tell how thick the mat is, you know what I mean? Like, so it's
bird's eye view.
Because it's bird's eye view. So I think it's just a combination of, like, you know, when you can see the ground, they've just purposely not done any stunts that would really require the extra mats.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they have, they've just specifically filmed it from angles where you can't notice the extra mats.
Yeah. Yeah. I have another question for you.
Okay.
It's about safety.
Uh-huh.
The cold open. Now, notoriously, I hate the cold opens.
Yeah.
This one in particular... The freaking coach goes up and is like, are you the morons in charge? And I'm like, babe, probably not the best way to open the conversation if you want to make any kind of progress.
Yeah.
But sure. Like, I get it. You're pissed. They're not meeting safety regulations. Well, they are, but like they wrote the regulations and they're purposefully shit. I get you're mad.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe don't address the CEO like that. Maybe start with, hi, are you such and such? I'm such and such. Here are my concerns about the safety of our performance. I'm sure you'd agree that it would be bad for everyone if someone got injured, particularly for your company's, like, you know, popularity or like what's the like the perspective of consumers, you know. But no, she was like, are you a fucking moron? I was like, probably maybe not the best.
Like, I admire her energy.
Yeah, and I understand her viewpoint.
Yeah.
However,
I do think maybe this is like there's been build up to this point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like maybe this is not the first time she showed up to a pep competition.
But
she's maybe previously voiced her concerns in a way that is not, are you the morons in charge?
I mean, yeah, but they've also clearly never met. So even if she's spoken to someone else, like, she has no way of knowing if her feedback or her concerns have actually been relayed. Yeah. So I was like, I don't know, babe. Maybe there's maybe a more professional way you could approach that. But number two, which is my actual problem with the cold open. Why is she doing CPR? Because the girl is clearly still breathing.
Yeah.
And if someone is, like, if their heart and lungs are working... Do not do CPR. You only fuck things up. CPR is only for when they're not breathing and or their heart is not pumping. Like,
I feel like that might just be a whoopsies in terms of production and staging. Like,
what are you doing?
I think they were like, we need a way to show that this injury is really serious.
Yeah.
And they were like, ah, we know CPR.
And
then
like,
maybe they just didn't think of the like consequences of being CPR of like,
how it's really bad if you don't need it.
Yeah.
That's like using a defibrillator on someone who is not having heart issues. Like, don't do that. That would be bad. anyway, so I just wanted to sprinkle dinkle that in there. Because that was one of my first notes was, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, I also feel like if Parker had just given the cheerleaders a demo of her skills with the lasers, they would have been 100% on board.
Yeah.
I feel like literally the only thing Parker needed to do was demo for them. Like, what, you don't want to? Look how easy it is. And they just do it. And they would all be in such awe of her incredible ability that they would have been like, we love you. We worship you. Show us your secrets. And then they would have just been golden.
I do want to quickly touch back on the coach for a second, because there was a point that I should have made previously that I realized I forgot to make, which is she has the line, you know, they technically train their gymnast, like their coaches, like I'm a fully qualified gymnastics coach,
mm-hmm.
but like the training for the cheerleading coaches is so, so more. Easy that a fry cook gets more training. Like,
yeah.
And I'm like, do you understand how much training it takes to be a fry cook? Like, do you know how much skill you have to have to be a good fry cook? Like, I don't think people understand just how hard it is to work as a fry cook. Like, that felt needlessly rude to me, to fry cooks.
Like, I think that it's one of those things that falls into, like, the quote-unquote category of unskilled labour.
Yeah.
And, like, the concept of unskilled labour is abhorrent to me.
Yeah.
I'm like, if you think that just anyone can walk off the street and do any job, you're an idiot who's clearly never worked in a quote-unquote unskilled job.
Mm-hmm.
Because there ain't no fucking way that, like, anyone could walk off the street into my job, and my job's considered entry-level unskilled labour.
Yeah.
There is no way. And say,
like, I worked essentially as a fry cook for many, many, many years.
Yeah. We did our time in
Let me tell you, when it takes a solid 12 months to train someone to be anywhere near half good at the job,
mm-hmm.
it takes a solid 12 months to train anyone to be anywhere near half good at the job.
It's like entry-level positions that require 3 years experience. It's like, well, it's not very fucking entry-level then, is it? Jesus. Like,
I don't think I actually have too much else to say about this episode. I really enjoyed this episode. I think it's really fun. I do love the fact that the villain is literally just, like, girl boss, you know, exemplified.
Mm.
I really respect that of them. Like, you know, women can be evil CEOs too.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoy that we had a female mark, because I do always think that's a little bit fun. And you're right, we don't get it really often. The one thing, though, that I would maybe criticize about it is I feel like it does fall into that, like, sort of trope of, like, women hating on women, particularly in this, like, field of, like, mm-hmm. cheerleaders and, like, that stereotype of the type of woman who is a cheerleader. And even, like, in the episode, she says, like, everyone wants to be pretty. And it's like, okay, like, that, like, narrative of, like, the cheerleaders are just the prettiest girls. And it's just like, I'm not saying cheerleaders aren't pretty, but I am saying, like, it's not the pinnacle of, you know, beauty. And I feel like that sort of narrative of, like, pitting women against each other and, like, that division that it sort of, like, causes, and especially, like, women being pitted against each other even within the same environments, like, within, like, the music industry or the fashion industry or, like, wherever, just, like, you know, in your general workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Women being pitted against each other is, like, such an unfortunate thing. And so it does bum me out to see, and I get that she's supposed to be kind of evil and that's the point, but it does bum me out to see a woman taking advantage of other women in a, specifically in women's sports where they're already severely undervalued, very, very underpaid. And also, like, these aren't just, like, women in sports. These are minor women in sports. Like, they're high school children.
They're teenagers.
She's not only, like, taking advantage of women, she's taking advantage of children. And actually, what I did like about this episode is we did have a variety of male cheerleaders in there as well. Mm-hmm. And, like, to be fair, cheerleading is not, like, a thing here.
No.
But I get the vibe that it's not very typically a sport that many men participate in. So I liked that there was a little bit of variety.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be a cultural thing. Like,
as to why it's not popular here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be like, it's like, why is netball not popular in the US? Well, because it's not, because it's an Australian sport. Yeah. Like, yeah. Duh. Or, like, AFL.
And I also think culturally, like, maybe, like, because, yeah, I agree. Like, I hate that it's kind of, like, women pitting against other women. But I think, like, culturally, that's just, like, it's an inherent element of cheerleading. So, like, I don't think it's really on leverage.
Oh, no.
I think it's, like, a societal thing that we just don't really get.
And that's right. It's not so much, I think it's leaning into a trope. Which, again, like, leverage does. Like, the point is to make a caricature villain. I mentioned it earlier. But it's just unfortunate that it's so prevalent, I guess.
And for me, like, I think, honestly, the fact that we see so many other women who, like, support each other. Like, because the entire squad, like, rely on and support each other. Just this one woman who's a fucking bitch. And, like, that's fine. Like,
and I really liked, actually, the scene with Parker and Madison.
Yeah.
Where she's saying, like, I understand that you're scared of letting down your team. I'm scared of that too. But I think that they would feel safer knowing that you were there rather than not be there at all. Like, even if you're worried you're going to make a mistake, like, it's okay. Like, everyone will make a mistake. And, like, yes, to be fair, like, the mistake that was made was obviously, like, a big one. But ultimately, like, it was no one's fault.
Yeah.
If it was anyone's fault, it was the fault of the company that was not providing the appropriate safety equipment, and that's the whole point of the episode. Like, And her teammates were clearly not holding it against her. Even the girl who was injured was not holding it against anyone. It wasn't her team's fault. And so I think that, like, that was a really nice little moment, especially for Parker to be like, because obviously, like, we've talked about all the way since season one, like, she's the one who is hardest to open up to people and to, like, establish that trust. And so for her to now be able to say to someone else, it's, you know, the worry that you'll let someone down is there, but just not being there at all is worse.
Yeah.
You know, like, she understands. And actually, that kind of maybe plays into the concept of Nate and Sophie maybe retiring.
Yeah.
Because, and that's what I was saying before, like, it could be viewed as abandonment by the other three. Like, that probably falls into that similar category of, like, well, if Nate and Sophie walk away, is it them just not being there to spot the other three that is going to feel like a betrayal?
Yeah.
Even though the other three are, like, more than capable of looking after and supporting themselves. Mm-hmm. Even if Nate and Sophie kind of become the Bobby equivalent, where it's just like, hey, you know, get on the phone and just double check with them things. Like, yeah. Anyway.
Anything else you want to add this week?
I really liked Sophie's little bit where she kept saying hoo-ha.
Oh, yes. The bit where she's like, that is a wardrobe malfunction. I can see her hoo-ha. Her hoo-ha.
She said it like 3 or 4 times, and every single time the accent became more pronounced, and it was so, I was like, the word hoo-ha is just such a silly word to start with, and then when you say it in an accent and you over-exaggerate it,
and with that much conviction, and that man's
panic, I just was like, this is really silly, but I really enjoyed it.
I also love the fact that she did in fact manage to get it reclassified as haberdashery for them.
Iconic. But, the only other thing I wanted to mention is just as like a thing where I was like, this feels silly.
Yeah.
Was when the, what are they? What's the name of the team? I can think is the Devils, but that's not it. The Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
When they go to like do their final performance, right? And so you hear the announcer on stage and Madison saying like, no, coach will be here. She'll be here. And they're waiting on Parker. Mm-hmm. And you hear the announcer be like, and now the Wolves or whatever. And the crowd's like, woo. And then Parker arrives. And then she's like, all right, team huddle. I'm like, guys, I think you've missed the time for team huddle. They've just announced you. You are supposed to be on stage. And then she's like, you know, they're taking a full 30 to 45 seconds to have their little team meet. Yeah. I'm like, guys, you can hear the crowd in the background too is no longer clapping. I'm like, you need to go. And it just seemed silly. I was like, Parker, I think it would have made more sense if they had just had the announcer say, like, and now the Wolves, right before they did the, like, hands in the middle thing, you know, that, I think just the timing of it would have just made it feel less weird. But, like, if you think about it from the audience perspective, they just announced this team, and then it's like, woo, and then no one arrives.
For a full minute, and then they come out on stage.
Yeah, I'd be like, are they good? You know, like, what's, they announced them, like, are they lost? You know, I was like, is someone in the bathroom? What is happening? So I just thought it was funny and I was like, they could have fixed that so easily and yet.
Okay, lovely. Well, how are you going to rate this week's episode then, Beth?
I am at a 3. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I could be swayed to a 3.5, but I just feel like as much as this episode was like really interesting for a number of reasons and
it's interesting, it's fun, but it's not really,
it didn't stand out.
Yeah.
It was like for Leverage personally, I was like, yeah, that's kind of mid.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I didn't not like it.
Mm-hmm.
I could be swayed to a 3.5, but like, I'm kind of ambivalent about it.
Yeah.
So I gave it a 3.
No, that's fine. I don't think that's out of line with anything you've said so far on the podcast. So I do want to ask you, though, next week's episode, it is called the D.B. Cooper Job. What do you think it's about?
I only know anything about D.B. Cooper from the BuzzFeed Unsolved episode regarding D.B. Cooper. So, and various Supernatural references. Yeah. So I'm going to say it'll be something to do with a plane.
Okay.
Potentially jumping out of one. Okay. Potentially involving a suitcase of money and a bomb threat.
Okay.
I think is the general.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
That's what I know about D.B. Cooper. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to assume it's maybe something in this vicinity.
So maybe someone's hijacking a plane.
Yeah. It's something to do with aircraft. Yeah. Something to do with maybe money. Something to do with maybe like a missing persons case.
Maybe something to do with parachuting.
Well, I said jumping out of a plane. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that kind of area, I think could be fun. It could also be, like, to do with, I mean, I just a missing persons case, but to do with, like, sort of the myth, the legend, you know? Like, it could be that kind of mm-hmm. take on, like, yeah. oh, the infamous blah, blah. Maybe mm-hmm. they find, like, maybe they're talking about, like, oh, my God, what a great heist. You know, they never yeah. found him or whatever. Like, maybe it's that kind of...
Like, Rashomon job sort of vibes?
Yeah, yeah. Like, maybe it's like, oh, my goodness, maybe they saw them. Maybe they meet D.B. Cooper. I don't fucking yeah. know. You know, mm-hmm. I think that it's probably going to be something very significantly relevant to the story of D.B. Cooper.
Okay, yeah.
If whether you're not familiar kind of, with him, then none of what I just said is going to make much sense. It's going to sound insane.
Whether it's they're actually looking at something to do with the D.B. Cooper case, or if it's there's something happening now that's very similar mirroring. To what
yeah. D.B. Cooper so, did. I basically think it could go down one of three ways. Either it is actually they're looking into yeah. the case of D.B. Cooper, or something is happening that mirrors the case of D.B. Cooper, or they are attempting to mirror the case of D.B. Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
One of those three. Although, we had a big plane story relatively recently. Mm-hmm. So, I don't really know why they would want to focus on aircraft again so soon. But
they love aircraft. That would be, like...
It's like Supernatural and Vampires. Like...
Because we've already had two previous airplane episodes.
Yeah, but one was really recent.
Mm-hmm.
So...
When was the first episode of the season?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one was season one, when Parker's the air hostess.
Yes. So, anywho, I think that it's... will be either one of those three things, basically.
All right, lovely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. If you want to talk to us about literally anything, but you can always find us on various social media platforms. And we suggest conversation topics every week, and I'm drawing a blank. But, like, what do you think your hook is?
Oh, yeah, yeah, actually, that's a really good question. What do you think your hook is? If you were going to be exploited,
yeah.
how would someone do it? What a weird question for us mm-hmm. to pose. But, you know, like yeah. at this point when you were watching the series, like, how did you feel about the discussion mm-hmm. he was having with Elliot? Because I've made my thoughts on it pretty clear. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested to know, like, what other perspectives might be. Yeah. And obviously, Jamie can't tell me right now.
No. Yeah.
But I'd be fascinated by the time this episode's airing to know other people's perspectives.
Yeah. And I think it's also really important to also mention that he's already had a very similar conversation with Hardison at yes. the start of the season as well. So this is not the first time we've seen this sort of conversation happening
mm-hmm.
in the sort of, like, underlying plot line of the season that's, you know, it's not yeah. really a plot line, but it's kind of like...
something's happening.
It's the narrative that does run through all of it, even if it's not a concrete plot line.
Yeah. I think I would be interested to see... maybe if he ends up having a similar conversation with Parker in the not too distant future, mm-hmm. and then if the three of them all end up, like, mentioning to each other, like, oh, mm-hmm. Nate's been kind of whack, and then yeah. there's some sort of confrontation
yeah.
situation. Like, I would not be surprised if that's uh-huh. kind of the way they roll with it. Or, like, Nate is like, I have an announcement kind of thing, yeah. you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Please have a lovely evening, afternoon, night, light, lunch, blah, 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 blah. Bye!
Bye.
My math stopped working for a second then.
Brain disconnected.